August 2002, I started my junior year of college at the University of Iowa. After my first week of classes, I walked over to Daydreams Comics to pick up the books that had been held for me over the summer months. As I flipped through the stack of comics, I came to a bizarre anomaly. An issue of Fantastic Four? I didn't have Fantastic Four on my pull list. Why would I? I'd never been a Fantastic Four fan. In my then 15 years of reading comics, I couldn't recall ever intentionally buying an FF book. I remember having one random issue, which a quick scan of Mike's Amazing World tells me was issue 370, that I'm pretty sure was part of a blind bag discount that my hometown shop would do, basically put 10 random issues in a brown paper bag with a $3 price tag, or 20 issues for $5, and you don't know what you were getting, but it basically amounted to quarter bin diving and gave the store a chance to clean out their old inventory. Beyond that, I knew the Fantastic Four characters from trading cards, cartoons, and as guest stars in a handful of Silver Surfer issues that I'd read in the 90s, but I wasn't a Fantastic Four fan, and I would never deign to collect their comic. So why was this issue in my pull list? Had to be a mistake, right? I walked over to the store owner to ask if he'd misplaced the book that should have been in someone else's stack, and as I did, I gave the cover a cursory glance. The Human Torch was in front, his signature flames covering all but his head, but he was at a curiously reduced size, like the Thing could grab him in both hands and smother the flames. There was something else a little unusual about Reed and Sue's faces. The art style reminded me of an animated series, though not completely. It was just something a little cartoonish, a little light, I guess is the word. And as a college kid about to turn 21 years old, the last thing that I wanted in my comics was lightness. The grimmer, the grittier, the better, know what I'm saying? Of course, the weirdest thing about the cover was the circular blister right over Mr. Fantastic's shoulder that declared, "Only 9 cents," and around the price point, "World's cheapest comic magazine." Was this a joke? A 9-cent comic? Is this a promotional thing like an ash can or something that fell out of a copy of Wizard? Or was Marvel really so desperate to get people to read The Forgettable Four that they weren't charging a dime? I showed it to the owner and said, "This doesn't belong in my pull list." Inexplicably, he said, "No, I put it there. Read it. You're gonna love it." I told him quite plainly that I didn't want to read it. I didn't like The Fantastic Four. "Trust me," he said, as if that would settle the matter. Thinking very much that it didn't settle anything, I set the book on the counter away from my intended purchases. He grabbed the book and defiantly put it back on top of my stack. "It's only 9 cents," he said. "Read it tonight, and if you think I cheated you, bring it back tomorrow and I'll give you your money back." The nerve of this man, basically shaming me into buying a book I didn't want because it was such a petty price tag that if I did come back expecting a refund, I would be the one who looked like an asshole. So, under protest, I bought the issue along with the rest of my stack. I took it back to my one-room efficiency apartment on Dubuque Street and tossed it on a stack of other comics and role-playing game manuals. I did not read it that night, or the next night, or any night that month. In September, I went back to clear out my pull list, and the next issue of Fantastic Four was there in my pile. I didn't fight with the guy, I just told the cashier I didn't want that issue, and I left without it. The next month, yet another issue of Fantastic Four was in my stack. Somehow, Fantastic Four had been added to my list without my authorization. In total, 5 issues had been held for me, and here's the thing, those comics didn't go away. When I said I didn't want those issues, the guys didn't put them back on the shelf for other customers. They went back into my file to await my return in a month or so. I amassed this sub-stack of Fantastic Four comics that I never had any intention of buying. And still, that first 9-cent issue went unread for almost 2 years. After I graduated in 2004, I went to Daydreams to cancel my subscriptions and clear out my list. Towards the end of my college years, I was reading a ton of prose, both novels and nonfiction, or I was reading graphic novels or trades. I wasn't really reading floppies, so by the time I went to Daydreams for the last time, I probably had 4 or 5 months worth of comics backed up, and I just paid for the whole lot without even skimming through them. That's how I ended up with those other Fantastic Four books that had been held for me for an absurd 2 years. I left Iowa City and moved back in with my parents while I looked for a job. All of the comics and toys and geek stuff that I had acquired during college went into the basement with my old comics and toys and geek stuff. And at some point, probably 2004, maybe even early 2005, I was down in the basement sorting through some of those books, trying to organize and file them in my long boxes. And I came to the stack of books from when I cleared out my pull list, and somehow, lumped in with those, was that first 9-cent issue of Fantastic Four, the one that the comic store owner shamed me into purchasing. And I think I just wanted to take a break from sorting those boxes, so sitting there on the basement floor, my back to the wall, I turned the cover, and I started to read. Fantastic Four, Volume 3, Issue 60, Legacy Numbering Issue 489. Inside Out, written by Mark Waid with pencil art by Mike Wieringo, inks by Carl Kiesel, colors by Paul Mounce, and letters by Richard Starkings and Albert Deschaine. In a shadowy boardroom, a presenter describes the bare-bones origin of the Fantastic Four, how scientist Reed Richards took his girlfriend Sue Storm and her brother Johnny on an exploratory spaceflight piloted by his best friend Ben Grimm. But Richards underestimated the radiation shield, and the quartet's ship was bombarded by cosmic rays. They crash-landed in California and emerged safe, but each miraculously changed. Reed could stretch his entire body and limbs and became known as Mr. Fantastic. Sue could turn invisible and was thus called the Invisible Girl. Johnny could ignite his entire body in flame and became the Human Torch. And Ben Grimm turned into a rocky orange monstrosity dubbed the Thing. They should have been freaks, outcasts, even lab experiments, but Reed sold them to the public as adventuring superheroes, pioneering Imaginauts. The lights come up in the room and we see that it's not some secret international cabal or shadowy deep state federal agents scheming against Fantastic Four. No, it is in fact a public relations firm hired by Reed Richards to increase the Four's popularity. The head of the firm assigns a junior PR guy named Schertzer to spend a week with the Fantastic Family and come up with a plan to get them whatever the 2002 equivalent of trending was. That's how Schertzer finds himself on the following Sunday sandwiched between a bickering Thing and Human Torch in the backseat of an interdimensional version of the Fantastic Car. Reed has taken the group, and Schertzer, into the Leviaverse to defend a living creature called the Datavore that harvests information about this particular dimension. But the Datavore is currently being swarmed by alien insects, killing the creature and destroying the research it has collected. As casually as jumping into a swimming pool, the Fantastic Four leap out of their ship and go to work protecting the Datavore. Sue uses her invisible force fields to push the insects back. Johnny tries to incinerate them, but these particular bugs turn out to be flame-resistant, and Johnny needs Ben to come and save him by clubbing the insects with his big stony fists. Reed says the insects shouldn't be killed anyway. They're not sentient lifeforms attacking the Datavore out of malice. They're just acting on instinct. The others buy Reed enough time to set up a little gizmo on the side of the Datavore that broadcasts a signal repelling the bugs. With that relatively simple task complete, they all get back in the interdimensional station wagon and head home for ice cream. Yeah, ice cream. Schertzer is awestruck by what he's seen, not just the fighting off alien bugs eating an alien whale, but the normalcy of the Four as family members who snap at each other and nag each other, but ultimately depend on each other. When the ship ports into the hangar of the Fantastic Four's Midtown headquarters, the Baxter Building, Scherzer meets the fifth member of the team, Reed and Sue's son, Franklin. Daddy Reed gives Franklin a glowing, probably not radioactive, macro atom as a souvenir from their trek. Sue tells Scherzer that their daughter, Valeria, is with her babysitter on the moon. Like that's a normal thing. After Reed walks off with Scherzer, Sue, Ben, and Johnny quietly wonder why Reed would hire a public relations firm at all. Why would he, of all people, care about their celebrity status? On Monday, Johnny and Sue show Mr. Scherzer how they repair the Baxter Building's security system. In this case, that means standing on one of Sue's invisible force fields outside the building some 20 stories up in the air. Sue tries to talk to Johnny about his recent breakup with actress Jennifer Garner. Meanwhile, Scherzer is utterly terrified of the heights and what appears to be standing on nothing. On Tuesday, the four spring into action when a lab accident spills anti-gravity liquid on the floor, sending equipment and unassuming scientists hurling into the air. Reed tells Johnny to burn the liquid, while Sue and Ben anchor Reed as he stretches high enough into the air to rescue the scientists before they fall to their deaths. In the aftermath, Sue tells Ben and Johnny that the scientists in question are part of a think tank called Cause Cerebral. Reed Richards is usually a regular fixture at their gatherings, but this year he wasn't invited. This causes Ben, Sue, and Johnny to turn on Scherzer, wondering if that slight is the reason he hired the PR firm. Scherzer makes the mistake of questioning the size of Reed's ego, and the family puts Scherzer in his place right quick. Even Johnny, the member with the lowest IQ and the least in common with his brother-in-law, is quick to point out that Reed's unparalleled level of genius makes the universe a better and safer place. And that's what the Fantastic Four is all about. That's why the family suits up and jumps into adventures on the far side of the galaxy, or even the far side of an electron, to support Reed's scientific endeavors. On Wednesday, Scherzer watches Ben and Sue go shopping in Soho. Sue carries baby Val in her arms, while Ben carries an antique grandfather clock that Sue probably just purchased. On the street, they come across a trio of hip-hop performers rapping about the Thing himself. They do a couple verses and give Ben a copy of their CD called Clobberin' Time, with probably an unlicensed photo of Ben on the cover. Ben, who is used to people thinking he looks like a rock monster, is flattered that these guys envy him enough to rap about him, even if he doesn't really care for the rap music. Or maybe he does, because on Thursday we catch Ben at home reading a book and repeating the lyrics to himself. On Friday, Reed and Sue take Franklin to the museum. Sue wants to know why he hired Scherzer's firm. At about the same time, a group of kids at the museum recognize them and ask for autographs. One of the kids refers to Reed as Mr. Elastic. Reed cites that as evidence that the Fantastic Four need a better public profile, not just for his ego, but for all of them. Sue doesn't seem convinced, though. On Saturday, Scherzer meets with a team of artists who show off the cover for the all-new, all-extreme FF comic book. That's F! Exclamation mark, F! Exclamation mark. And the redesigned costumes that make the Fantastic Four look in your face. Well, Scherzer almost laughs them out of the room, and he tells them what he's discovered in spending a week with the family. That you don't get people to care about Mr. Fantastic, the Invisible Woman, the Human Torch, and the Thing by jazzing up their costumes. You focus on the people inside. The costumes don't matter because they're an after effect. The Fantastic Four aren't superheroes. They're Imaginauts, explorers, pioneers, adventurers. The fact that they save the day from cosmic threats is just a byproduct. Scherzer leads the artists out of the Baxter Building, telling them he has ideas for how the firm can help the Force image. But he still doesn't understand why they were hired. He can't figure out why Reed Richards cares about the Force popularity. This last part is overheard by Reed, who carries baby Val to her nursery. He confesses to his infant daughter the truth that he couldn't tell Scherzer, or Sue, or the others. Once upon a time, he says, there was a genius who... He corrects himself. A very bright man who... He stops again, and looks across the room to a photograph of himself, Sue, Ben, and Johnny, in their spacesuits, doubtless the last photo taken of them before they rocketed off to their destiny with the cosmic rays. Once upon a time, Reed says, looking crestfallen, there was a very arrogant man who did something very stupid. He puts Val in her crib and says that his hubris sent the four of them into space without proper shielding, and his mistake changed their lives forever. Their transformations would have made them freaks, hated and feared like mutants, or worse, lab specimens to be studied and probed. To save them from that horrible fate, though, Reed made them celebrities, working out in the open with garish superhero costumes and names like Mr. Fantastic and the Human Torch ensured that nobody would be scared of them. Reed's mistake could have ruined the lives of the people he loved more than anything forever. But by making them famous adventurers with their own comic books and action figures, while Sue and Johnny and Ben might never lead normal lives again, at least they wouldn't be shunned and hated by the public. And if their lives were still pleasant enough, maybe someday they would forgive Reed. And maybe then he could forgive himself. Suddenly, the door to Valeria's nursery bursts open and Ben and Johnny rush in, dressed in buckskin outfits and Native American headdresses. Apparently, they were playing with Reed's time machine and now Davy Crockett needs some help. With that, the Fantastic Four rushes off to unwild the West, and from there, another grand adventure waits. Before getting into my impressions of the story, I will quickly address the art of the late, great Mike Wieringo. His work didn't look like anything I was used to seeing at that point. As I said when I looked at the cover, there's an almost cartoonish quality to the character models and how they occupy the space. It kind of reminds me of the Bruce Timm-designed Batman in Justice League animated series, with a little bit of the Incredibles, too. Not entirely, it's not a directly influenced or it's not a one-to-one, but as far as I know, I don't know, they seem comfortably similar. And as for those character models, I was most taken with how Wieringo rendered Sue Richards, a character that I never gave more than a second thought before this reading. She had a cool modern hairstyle that evoked one of the girls of Friends, maybe, but she also had this playful attitude, the way she flirted with Reed in front of her brother just to make him uncomfortable, and the way she responded both verbally and physically when Scherzer is clinging to her body for stability outside the 20th story of the Baxter Building. It's sexy without being cheesecake, which should not sound like a radical idea, but remember, when I first read this issue, like 90% of my comic book buying and collecting at that point was during the 90s, and most of it was informed by the extreme era. So, what about the story itself? Well, if ever a single issue was written just for me, it was this issue. I was the person who didn't care about the Fantastic Four. I was the person who thought they were lame and outdated and uncool. And right there on the first two pages, that premise is laid bare for me. People think the FF is lame. How do we prove them wrong? One of the ways that I latched onto back then were the droves of pop culture references that Mark Waid dished out, name-checking Howard Stern, Danny Bonaducci, Poochie the Dog, even Wizard Magazine. Today, I bristle at some of these names. Would a new reader even understand the Poochie reference? Does that count as a deep cut now? At the time, though, those references made the story feel modern and relevant, which prior to that, I didn't think the Fantastic Four were, so, you know, good job, Mark. The story also revealed just enough of the depth of Sue and Johnny's characters to pique my interest for more. We didn't get a whole lot of introspection on them in this one-off, but I learned there was more to them than just their powers. And then there's Reed Richards. I will admit right now, to my eternal shame, that all of my prior disinterest in the Fantastic Four is all because of Reed Richards. It wasn't that I thought the group was lame and stupid. It's that I thought their leader was, so much so that I even did consider collecting the book briefly in the 90s when Ant-Man replaced Reed in the lineup after I saw them guest star in an issue of Silver Surfer. But how could I detest Mr. Fantastic so much when I had so little familiarity with the character? Remember how I was an impressionable teenager during the extreme 90s? Yeah, I grew up on grunge rock. I liked my heroes with long hair and trench coats and mysterious glowing eyes and big cybernetic guns. Yeah, I was stupid as a kid, but that was the in-vogue thing. And Reed Richards, he had short hair and... gasp! Was that a white stripe or, like, gray at the temples? Oh my god, the dude was old! He was married! He had kids! In my teenage worldview, you couldn't be less cool than that. I wanted nothing to do with Mr. Fantastic and, by extension, the whole family. But a decade later, I read this issue. Now, understand, I had done a bit of personal growth during this period, too, and even though, being newly graduated from college, the last thing I wanted then was a wife and kids, I could at least recognize the narrative benefits and dramatic opportunities that that could give a character. So, I was no longer in the mindset to outright dismiss Reed Richards. But even if I had been, I think this story would have turned me around. I was already impressed by how Reed came across as a take-charge man of action in just a few scenes in the beginning of the book. Definitely not what I expected. And then, when we got to the final reveal, when he's bearing his soul to his daughter, confessing that the whole reason he created the supergroup with these outlandish names and costumes was to absolve himself for the guilt he felt for screwing up the lives of his family. Whew. When I read that scene, Mr. Fantastic rocketed to the top of my favorite characters list, and he has stayed there ever since. Even reading that scene now, years later, it has a whole new resonance for me now that I am a family man with my own child. And many a night have I held him in my arms and unburdened myself of my secret dreams and regrets that I would never share with anyone else. If it hasn't come across yet, this is one of, if not my very favorite comics of all time. I think it's a perfect jumping on point for someone who, like me, either doesn't know much about the FF or maybe has a negative view of them. It gives you the origin, little snapshots of the characters, a new frame with which to view their group dynamic, and a lot of heart and humor. And it's all in a self-contained one-shot, a done-in-one wonder, if you will. Yes, I think it is my favorite single issue I've ever read. It is certainly one of the most influential, as it turned me from a hater into a lifelong Fantastic Four fan, and made the character that I previously detested now my favorite in the Marvel stable. So suck on that, Professor Allen. I don't know if the owner of Daydream Comics in Iowa City predicted any of that when he forced me to buy that issue, but I am sure glad that he did. And as it turned out, a fortunate consequence of me waiting 2 whole years before I read the issue was that by the time I devoured issue 60 and the others that were in my stack, there were like 4 trade paperback volumes of the Wade Wieringo run for me to pick up at my local bookstore. I consumed them like Galactus, and then I needed more. I started picking up the essential Fantastic Four volumes to read the original Stanley and Jack Kirby stories, and then the first John Byrne omnibus. I followed Mark Waid's run with J. Michael Straczynski's, and then Dwayne McDuffie's, and then Mark Miller's, and then Jonathan Hickman's. I've started reading the new series that just came out, and I filled in some of the gaps through the Marvel Unlimited app and listening to shows like the Fantasticast. I just recently completed my Marvel Legends Fantastic Four, acquiring all 4 of the Walgreens exclusive 6-inch figures, and special thanks to Siskoid, by the way, for hooking me up with the Human Torch. You know, whenever someone on this network, it's usually Shag, says, "Find your joy," I think of Fantastic Four issue 60. If you haven't read it yet, I encourage you to do so, and if you have read it, I hope it brings you as much joy as it brings me. And that is going to be all for this episode of FW Presents. Please like and share this episode on Facebook, favorite and retweet on Twitter, and if you have anything to say, please leave a comment on any of those social media or the website post for Fire and Water Podcast Network. As always, thanks for listening.